Anybody shouted out, liked it, hated it, waste of money, going to be back next year. I tagged the elevator, so therefore I had a good time. Anybody?
Well, that one's everybody. Fun.
Fun? You had fun? How many people in the room thought they had fun this year? How many people are going to be back next year?
Where's it going to be?
Oddly enough, probably here. The hotel actually invited us back. No, no, they honestly, I mean, well, considering the fact that the only time that this hotel actually does business are when all of the other hotels, the nice ones in Detroit, are full. So when on weekends and weeks when there's absolutely nothing going on, they have maybe a 10% occupancy rate. And thanks to Rubicon, they had something close to like a 70 or 75% occupancy rate. Like, they made some mad cash, like, out of no reason, both from the con organizers and the people who stayed. So everybody who had a hotel room, we thank you because you're the reason that we actually got invited back.
Yeah.
What?
Not
in here, no.
Okay, good.
But I'd like to keep that Macintosh plugged in if I can.
Yeah. Do you need network port or do you need, because I'm going to pull the stuff.
You're going to pull all of it?
I'd like to pull a bunch of it. Wait.
Can you just keep that plugged into and stuff?
I'm
going to
get the crap out of the phone.
Okay, whatever. If you can move the Mac in the phone room, that'd be beautiful. Okay, fine. Do what you need to do. All right. Okay. So the title of the speech is Hackers and the Society of Accidental Guardianship. Are you recording this, Josh? Thank you. I guess the first thing I'd like to say is that when I say hacker, I'm using perhaps the most broad definition possible. I'm including everyone from the Tech Model Railroad Club that Stephen Levy talks about in his book Hackers, which if you haven't read, is actually a very, very good book. There are two books that you have to go out and get. Actually, both of Stephen Levy's books, Crypto and Hackers, I think are required reading for anybody who is interested in this scene at all. It has all of the stories, a lot of trivia that we talked about last night, and they're really entertaining reads. Stephen Levy is a real good writer of social science. It's not like reading a boring textbook. You're actually getting involved into the story and getting excited while you're reading it. The other book, which is a little bit more boring, but it's short and it's actually quite insightful, is The Hacker Ethic. I'm taking a lot of the first two parts of my speech out of this book. The Hacker Ethic by Pekka Himanen. The foreword is by Linus Torvalds, who I'm sure you all know. And the epilogue is by Manuel Castells, who's done a lot of research and a lot of thinking about the information age. You know, as I'm sure you're all aware of the industrial age and the fact that that's pretty much where what our economy is based out of and what people use as the buzzword for the economy. We know that we're slowly getting out of the industrial age and entering into the information age, but we don't know anything about the information age yet. We're clearly not there. And Manuel Castells has done a lot of really good thinking for close to 20 years about what it means to be in the information age, where we're headed, and how we'll know when we're actually all the way there. But getting back to the original point, I'm using an extraordinarily broad definition of hacker. Just basically anybody who considers themselves a hacker, whether they're, you know, the lamest AOL instant message kiddie out there who's maybe pulled two scripts on a website that didn't work. You know, someone who can't get the IIS exploit to work is like the low end of what I'm talking about when I talk about hacker. The high end, of course, you know, people like Linus Torvalds, Eric S. Raymond, Code Gods. People who are really, really fucking good at what they do. And basically anybody who uses computers as the large part of their social interaction with the world is what I would consider a hacker. Somebody who likes computers for the sake of computers. You know, I'm not even talking about coders who do it simply for a job. There are a lot of really shitty-ass programmers out there who are just doing it to get paid. They don't like what they do. It's not their passion. I'm talking about people who have a real passion for computers. So when I say hacker, I'm not using any white hat, cracker, black hat distinctions. Even people who, if they, you know, DOS everything in sight, if they really love DOSing everything in sight, they actually fit the definition that I'm going to use for the purpose of this talk. All right. The first thing I'd like to bring up, which Linus talks about in the foreword to this book, is Linus's law. This is a kind of simplified social science theory that Linus came up with when writing the prologue for this book. He says that humanity is basically broken down into three separate parts. One is survival, eating, breathing, reproduction to a certain extent. The second thing is a social life, our interactions with other people, what we do, you know, in our daily life. Work can be considered a part of our social life, or at least in his definition, he considers it part of our social life. Work is also work in terms of, you know, what you do and your interactions with your coworkers as part of social life, but work to get money so that you can buy stuff to survive, you know, is part of the survival part of it. And the third one is entertainment, which is pretty self-explanatory. You know, we like to be amused. Most of us, most normal people don't like to work for money all the time. They like to go out and enjoy that money. You know, many people consider Rubicon entertainment. And I think that's a valid reason. The reason we started this whole thing was to have a really big party for hackers. You know, the original spirit behind the first DEF CON. But when Linus says entertainment, he also includes why, like, the motivation for hacking. Hackers don't hack for survival. Usually if they have a computer, they probably have food on the table and a roof over their heads. Survival is taken care of. Hackers do tend to hang out with other hackers and meet other hackers and use the computer as a large part of their social life. I mean, look at the proliferation of instant messaging services. Look at IRC. Hackers do use computers for their social life. But hackers, in my definition, hack for the third reason of Linus's law, entertainment. They do it because they like what they do. It's their passion. You know, whether it's taking down websites or figuring out a packet exploit, coding something, trying to get it to work, trying to figure out more, they're doing it, under my definition, because they really like to do it. They get geeked when something works. They spend hours upon hours, days, months, years getting things to work. You know, Linus had a really, really difficult job while he was coding Linux. You know, he had two jobs, but one of them he was doing for the love. He would get home really late at night, start checking his email, and start going through all of the things to try to get his kernel to work better in communicating with other people. There's another important distinction here. Hackers, the line between social life and entertainment is really blurred. You know, even though everybody involved in Linux and in open source projects were doing it for entertainment because they liked doing what they did. They liked coding. They liked getting things more stable, more efficient, and getting them to work better. It was also a large social interaction there. They built communities. There were people in there who actually liked talking with other people. And, you know, a lot of them didn't like it. You know, disagreeing with people, having enemies in a scene, but still having to work with them, is still a part of the social life under Linus's law. And Pekka pretty much takes the entertainment point and kind of repackages it into passion. You know, like I said before, hackers hack for a passion. And then it's interesting, he moves into another area. He starts talking about the hacker ethic. And before he starts talking about the hacker ethic, which is a little bit different from what we all know as the hacker ethic, so please bear with me as I try to explain the two. He talks about the Protestant ethic. And anybody who is studying social science or actually pretty much only people who are studying social science will read Max Weber. And in that, he talks about the Protestant ethic, which is the dominant set of rules for the industrial age, the old guard, what we're moving out of. He talks about, or Pekka breaks it down into 7 points of what the Protestant ethic means. And just the 7 buzzwords are money. You know, people work for money. It's a survival part of that. People also work and try to do a good job. You know, it's, you know, one of the values of the Protestant ethic is working because it's your duty. You know, it comes out of an old Catholic monasterial thing where the idea was, before the industrial age in monasteries, was that you don't, or God doesn't want you to pray all day. That's not serving God. God wants you to work. Work is your duty. Doing a good job is something that people who follow the Protestant ethic value. You know, doing a bad job is frowned upon. Even if you absolutely fucking hate your job, you still have to do a good job because it's your duty. People who do a good job are rewarded. And people do a good job more often than not, not for the additional rewards that it brings, but simply because that's a part of the ethic. The next one is optimality. People in the Protestant ethic optimize. It's why in hard times people get laid off. They're trying to make the system optimal, trying to work for efficiency. While a lot of things in the Protestant ethic and in the industrial age are very inefficient, optimality and efficiency is a value. You want to try to make things efficient. You want to try to cut costs that you don't need. You want to try to make more and more money as you're going along while at the same time streamlining your organization. It's why people pay so much money to consultants to basically tell them to, you know, restructure, reorganize. You know, restructuring, reorganizing corporations is extraordinarily inefficient. But people do it because they're seeking efficiency. They go through an extraordinarily inefficient process in pursuit of the perfect thing. I mean, yes, there are a lot of egos and things like that involved, but the end goal is to try to make things more efficient. The fourth one is kind of odd, and I don't know where he was going with this one, but he said flexibility. That while structures are very rigid and are very defined in the Protestant ethic, people have to be flexible. You know, if a curveball is thrown your way, you have to deal with it. You know, we kind of saw a little bit about that going on in the cafe downstairs. You know, the goal is to try to be flexible. You know, when you're handed 125 people who weren't supposed to be here and came out of nowhere and who all want a cheeseburger and fries, you know, the expectation is that you'll do what you can to try to do that and that that's part of your duty. You know, it all goes back to the work is duty thing. They obviously didn't do that. They obviously didn't care that much, and we were disappointed. We expected more of them simply because that's what we expect in the Protestant ethic, a certain degree of flexibility. The next one, of course, is stability. You know, as we go on and on and along and plod through the industrial age, we keep on inventing systems to try to make the system more stable. It's why we have the Federal Reserve. It's why the Federal Reserve and the United States government have the single largest control over the capital that's involved in the United States. You know, everybody pays taxes to the government controls that money. It's in the government's interest to keep the system as stable as possible. You know, one of the most obvious goals of government is to stay around until tomorrow. You know, it's so obvious that we don't even think about it, but that is one of the goals of government. That is the primary goal of government, to stay in power. And it all goes back to the Protestant ethic notion of stability. You can kind of infer from there. The other one is determinacy. And this is kind of where egos and things like that start to fall into play, that in the Protestant ethic, there's a real strong tendency towards determinacy, finding out what the motivations are of the people around you, finding out, you know, why people do what they do. You know, anybody who's worked in a corporate environment or even in some school environment, student clubs and things like that, while you may not realize it, a lot of what's going on in your mind, in the subconscious, is trying to determine the motivations of those around you. You know, why is that person doing what they're doing? It doesn't seem logical. You know, it was going on a lot in the Rubicon Core group. You know, there were some really strong personality conflicts. And a lot of the time, we would be talking, you know, behind each other's back, sort of like saying, well, you know, why did Rob do that? Why did Jim do that? Why did Rob and Jim go off deciding to quarter? You know, what's going on with Brian? You know, especially in any kind of big enterprise, you see a lot of that deterministic backdoor, you know, not necessarily backstabbing, but we waste a lot of time in the Protestant ethic and in the industrial age trying to determine what are the motivations of the people around us. And the last one is result accountability. If you fuck up, you're responsible for it. That's a given part of the Protestant ethic. Then he goes on to identify the hacker ethic. And when I say hacker ethic, bear with me as I try to, you know, plod through this. He's drawing together a lot of different ideas and adding one really big one on his own. And as I'm explaining these, think about the ones that I just explained. Think about those set of rules as the way that our economy and our society works today, that's our value set. That's the set of rules that guide our interactions. And then as I'm explaining these ones, think about how these are going to replace, as we move in the information age over the next 150 to 200 years, think about how these ideas are going to replace the ones that I just explained. The first one, which I've been hitting on way too much, is passion. You know, instead of working for money or working for your duty, you're working because you like what you do. You know, in job interviews and things like that today, one of perhaps the most important, if not the most important thing, one of the most important things is whether or not this person can do the job. You know, obviously, that's part of the Protestant ethic. It's very utilitarian. Can this person do the job? If they can, I will hire them. If they can't, I won't. In the hacker ethic, the most important thing in determining whether or not you're going to hire this person for the job is not necessarily whether they're capable, but whether they really like what they're doing. When you're sitting across from them in an interview, instead of figuring out whether or not, you know, they know how to program in C, you're going to be looking for whether or not they really like programming and whether or not you think that they're excited about programming and know just a little bit from which they can expand and grow and be eager to work in C. You know, that's one of the most important things. Not whether or not the person is absolutely capable and has the skill set there, but whether or not they can acquire the skill set. I know it's kind of a weird idea to think that that's the most important thing that an employer is going to be looking for, whether or not they really like the job that's put out in front of them. It's kind of, I mean, does anyone think that's a weird idea? Do they think that makes sense? I mean, but do you honestly believe that that's going to be the most important thing employers are going to be looking for in the next, you know, 100, 150 years?
Yeah, when I was interviewing,
a lot of employers actually were we're seeing this today. We've been seeing these trends for the past 15 years. We just haven't been identifying them very carefully. You know, especially in IT, you know, anybody who's hired someone to work in an information technology department will know the people that have the skill set and are going to fuck around and show up late and, you know, just do the minimum that they can do to get by. You know, they're going to be really good at solving the problems that nobody else can solve, but do you want to hire that guy? Or do you want to hire the guy that's really, really excited about learning your network, about learning how things run, about making sure that every detail in your network, from whether or not the routers are up 99% of the time to whether or not, you know, the CEO's secretary always has printer or always has paper in their printer, excuse me. You know, which of those two guys are you going to hire? The second guy, more often than not, will always get hired, even though that they don't really know what they're doing. If you know that they're capable of getting excited about their job and learning it and being really good at it, enjoying it, you're going to hire them. The second one is a little bit more obvious, freedom. You know, the Protestant ethic is often referred to as the iron cage. You know, it's, while the iron cage, of course, keeps us in, it also protects us from the outside. There's the expectation that we will be protected from all the things that would seek to harm us in the Protestant ethic. Hackers are very, very concerned with freedom. You know, open source. That's an inherently free technology. Things like hacktivism, you know, that's about freedom. You know, a lot of, you know, trying to break standards and reverse engineer things that corporations have provided to us is about that empowering sense of freedom. The third one is social worth. You know, hackers, a lot of hackers' motivation is based on finding the coolest hack, getting the coolest code, making a name for yourself, running a con, making a stupid game show to get social worth and recognition in, you know, the scene. That's a lot of what powers hackers. It powers people in the Protestant ethic too, but it's for a little bit different of a reason. Whereas hackers are eager about contributing to the scene, about being recognized for their achievements in the scene, it's not because hackers have huge egos. It's because hackers, by the ethic, by participating in the scene, accept that social worth is an important part of it. It's not because they want to be like, I am the greatest hacker in the world because I'm so fucking cool. I mean, yeah, there is a lot of that, but it's not motivated out of ego. It's not motivated about, because I'm high in the scene, I can leverage all of the people in the scene from now on. I can call in favors. No. I mean, the most recognized people in the hacker scene have far and away not asked for any favors in return from the scene, but they get things. It's like Eric S. Raymond's concept of the gift. I'm giving to you. Like hackers say when they write things, when they code things, when they deface things even. They say, I'm giving this to you. I'm giving this code to you. I'm giving this website back to you. And the whole motivation is to keep giving simply for the sake of giving. Not giving because you think, okay, well, if I give this person a present on their birthday, that means on my birthday, they're obligated to give me a present. You know, I mean, can you see the fundamental distinction between the two? Is that pretty clear? Okay. The fourth one is openness. Of course, this relates back to freedom, you know, open source, reverse engineering codes, and just generally being open. You know, one kind of weird way to explain this is rumors, things like that. Rumors circulate in hacker communities in a fundamentally different way. In Protestant ethic communities, a lot of that whole ego play is going on. You know, when rumors are circulating and floating around, people will tend to add things to it or take away things from it based on what it thinks that they'll get them. You know, in the hacker community, rumors, you know, while of course some of that happens, rumors circulate in a much more intact way. You know, seven generations afterwards, when you hear something, you're pretty much going to get the same version of the story as the first person who told it to the second person. You know, the details may have changed and people might have added or embellished or taken things away, but they didn't do it out of ego. You know, they did it out of because it created a more amusing story, a more amusing hack. The core story stays the same. The details are different. In Protestant ethic rumor circles, the details stay more or less the same. The circumstances stay more or less the same, but the core story changes a lot. The fifth one is activity. Hackers like to keep busy. Watching TV, you know, for 6 hours a day is not a very valued thing in the hacker community. Reading Slashdot for 6 hours is a valued thing in the community. I mean, honestly, the hacker community, just of people who are into Slashdot or groups, sites like Everything Too and things like that, read and contribute to those sites on average for twice as long as the average for people who just sit around and watch TV who aren't hackers. But what are they doing? The fundamental difference between just sitting out and watching TV and sites like Slashdot is that sites like Slashdot are always keeping you active. You're always either participating in the discussion groups, moderating the discussion groups, clicking through all of the different links, seeing, oh yeah, I think I read an article about that, searching for another article, submitting articles. Slashdot is very interactive. You know, within the system itself, or from the user to the system, and from user to user. Activity. It's one of the things that is valued. Hackers don't just sit around and, you know, they don't just sit around. They like doing things. And even when they're sitting around, they're very active. Hackers, by and large, are very good conversationalists. I mean, you know, there are some very notable exceptions to that, but as a general rule. The second to last one is caring. Like I said, the whole gift-giving thing. Hackers care, you know. When I was up on stage, you know, drinking my ass off, you know, and I collapsed, you know, they took me to the hospital. You know, people I didn't know, someone who I met on IRC and had spent literally no more than 5 minutes talking to, stayed with me for 8 hours at the hospital. Caring is a large part of the hacker ethic, you know, and it's what makes Con so much fun, because people are actively caring for each other. They like meeting new people. And I mean, it works the other way too. Some of the most intense and passionate hatreds that have ever come up for the most stupid reasons come up in hacker communities. And that's also a facet of caring. You really have to care enough about what someone said or about what someone did to hate them. I mean, it just, like, all of these points work both ways. They're both positive and negative. The one thing I really want to get across about this is that I'm not saying that the hacker ethic is better than the Protestant ethic. Social scientists, there are two schools of social scientists. One that like to make judgments, saying this system is better, it's just inherently better because it's better. And the others say, well, you know, societies and things like that, there's no way that you can compare them. It's like apples and oranges. You can't say that, you know, the society of Aborigines in Australia is any better than our society, you know, because Aborigines in Australia, that's just the way they are. People in the United States, that's just the way they are. What I'm trying to explain here is that the Protestant ethic is the way that we are. The hacker ethic is what we're moving to. And I'm not saying that one's necessarily better than the other, but in the hacker ethic, that's the kind of things that we're going to be seeing, you know, over the next 10, 15, 20 years. I'm not saying it's better. I personally think it's better, but I'm part of the school of social scientists that's going to say that I can't say that it'll be better for everybody. It's going to be a really difficult period of transition. It is a difficult period of transition right now that we're in. And it'll be better for some people. It'll be better for us. It's our ethic they're adopting. All right. We're in the same position that the monks were in the 16th century before the industrial age started. They're taking our ideas that are old and refined, and they're basing, or and you know, through various different unrelated channels and unrelated processes and many different methods, the information age is taking our ethic and using it to reconstruct society. I mean, it's a very exciting thing, but I just want to emphasize that I don't think it's necessarily or inherently better. It's just what we're going to be. And the last part, which Himanen states is probably the biggest one, is the emphasis on creativity. You know, especially in hacking. A lot of, you know, the complaints leveled against script kiddies is that they're not doing anything creative. They're doing something that's been done before, you know. And while that's true to a certain extent, I don't think script kiddies are out there defacing the exact same websites that were defaced, the exact same websites that are vulnerable to the same exploits that have been documented for 2 fucking years and nobody's updated their site yet. Sorry, personal grudge. But, you know, creativity is one of the most important things about the hacker ethic. The script kiddie, when they have the script, is not going to go out and deface the same website that was defaced 2 years ago on attrition. They're going to try to find a new site. They're going to try to find a new way to do it. You know, hacks or speak, recreating the way that we speak. It's an inherently creative thing. You know, it's not slang. It's not, well, I mean, it is a form of slang, but it's a creative way of speaking in the English language. I mean, that's what I'm saying when, those are the kind of things when I mean creativity. Probably all of the things that really annoy you and piss you off about the hacker community, all those like little, you know, like smiley faces, emoticons, those really piss me off sometimes because you can't, there's no way that you can express emotion through email. I mean, we're getting there. We're getting a lot better at using textual cues in email as the years go on. And I think it's going to be a lot more effective mode of communication as we as a society learn how to use it. But, you know, creativity is the last kind of tying idea that brings all of those ideas together. And so that's what I mean when I mean the hacker ethic. I mean it as a counterpoint to the Protestant ethic. And here I'm kind of moving into the title of the speech, and I have to make one point first. Hackers, as I've defined them, are not a subculture, not a culture unto themselves, but they're a scientific society. How many people have I lost in the room when I said that? Really? Nobody? Damn.
You lost me. Explain it more.
Huh? Thanks, George. Everybody give a round of applause to George, who kicked my ass last night and won NFF's t-shirts. Always helpful. Hackers, just for the point of argument, and this, I know that the social scientists in the audience, if there are any, are going to say, okay, your argument is extraordinarily flawed. You have to, you know, you just can't do that. And yes, I can't do that. I'm not using this in the paper that I'm still writing that this speech is based on. But I thought it was the most convenient example that I can express quickly. Hackers as a scientific society are like doctors and medicine as a scientific society. And I'm just going to try to contrast them in a couple of fundamental ways. In the medical society, medicine in general, you have the same kind of gradations as we find in hacker society. You have the geniuses, the people who are recognized and admired by all. Salk, inventor of the polio vaccine. Can't remember any other really big names in medicine, but the people who do research, the people who find new ways, the people who invent medicines are the gods of the medical community. Really good doctors, you know, in curing patients and treating disease, are not as well respected as you think they might be in the medical community when you look at it as a scientific community. When a whole bunch of doctors get together for conferences like this, the people who are respected, the people who everybody wants to talk to, are the researchers, the people who have maybe seen 2 patients in their entire career. It's just kind of a funny thing. And then, of course, in the middle range, you have the doctors. You know, there are really good doctors like I was talking about. There are really good and really unrecognized people in the hacker community. You know, people who aren't necessarily code geniuses, people who aren't necessarily, while they are really good at what they do, they're still kind of applying the same solutions. They don't completely live up to the creative ideal. You know, they're not seen as really creative godlike people. Yes, they publish some very good work. They do a lot of really good things. But they're just like good doctors. They're not widely recognized and widely idolized in the hacker community. And then, of course, you have the people at the lower end. You know, you have the script kiddies, the people who do the exact same things over and over and over again. You know, while they do have a certain creativity and a certain thing about their work and are intelligent, you know, and are learning as they go along, you have the people in the medical community, new doctors. You know, how many people have walked into the ER, had one, you know, obviously old, experienced doctor say, "Hi, this is Ralph, the intern. He's the one who's going to be treating you, and I'm going to be observing him." Has that ever happened to anyone? Well, apparently it happened to me, and it struck fear in the people who were taking care of me. Detroit Receiving is a teaching hospital, which is pretty short for, which is, teaching hospital in the medical community is kind of a standing joke. If you're a patient at a teaching hospital and you don't have, you know, a really rare disease or a disease that, you know, is going to involve teams of MDs and PhDs to diagnose and treat, you're fucked. You know, if you go into the University of Michigan hospital with a gunshot wound and you come out with your liver, consider yourself lucky. But anyway, that's kind of the point that I was trying to make. You have the, you know, you have the nurses who are either really good or really bad. You have medical practitioners, just a more glorified form of nurse. You have a lot of people on the lower end in the hacker community, just like you have a lot of, the bulk of the people in the hacker community are on the lower end. Just like the bulk of the people in the medical community, the people doing all the grunt work are on the lower end in the medical, or in the medical community, yeah. And so that's what I mean when I say hackers are a scientific society. I'm going to develop this and come up with it a lot more, but for the point of this paper, that was the quickest distinction I could draw. I mean, does anyone find a really inherent flaw with looking at it that way? Go ahead.
Can't a scientific community also be a
subculture? Yeah, I know, I didn't explain that for real. Thank you. Yeah, doctors, by and large, hang out with other doctors. They like to golf with, you know, other doctors, people who understand what they do. Yes, there are subculture aspects to it. I mean, I guess what I'm trying to say is that scientific society is a subset of a subculture. It's a subculture whose basis is grounded in a certain root. You could say that the Hippocratic Oath is the ethic of the medical community, you know, basically to make people well, just like the hacker ethic is the core of the hacker community. But they're both scientific societies. Hackers deal with computers. Hackers deal with recognized systems. You know, they deal with very organized communications infrastructures, just to broadly put it, to include freakers and everybody else who's involved in that. Doctors deal with medical technology, things to make people well, everything from, you know, the least complicated pill to the most complicated dialysis machine. You know, they're two fundamentally different technologies, but they're both there to make you well. Hackers deal with communities, or hackers deal with technologies that are meant to communicate. You know, whether it's something as simple as, you know, whether it's something as simple and as plain as a telephone network. You know, you pick it up, you dial 7 or 9 numbers, shit works. You know, it's a very simple technology, but hackers take it to it, or freakers, which are a big part of the hacker community, take it to the next level. You know, why when I hit 1 does the switch know that I'm about to make some kind of long distance call? You know, they honestly want to know why. It's a question that the vast majority of phone users would never ask themselves. You know, it's a pain. It's like, okay, I gotta dial long distance or I gotta fucking dial 1, you know? Hackers really want to know why. Why is that? Or freakers specifically want to know why. You know, it all goes back to passion in the hacker community. So, yeah, they maintain all of the aspects of a subculture, just like doctors maintain all the aspects of a subculture. But what unites them is not something. Like Trekkies, for example. They're a large, big subculture. There's a lot of overlap with the hacker community. But what unites them all? A cultural ideal. You know, they're not everyone is there necessarily doing anything. Hackers are always doing something. Doctors are always doing something. It goes back to the court. What are Trekkies doing? They're worshiping the story. They're like fucking putting on their little Spock ears and crap like that. You know, they're not doing anything. They're participating in a subculture which has a very set defined stories, a sort of ideals. It's different from an ethic. Trekkies follow an ideal, you know, the ideal of Star Trek. It means many different things to many different people, but they're following a cultural construct as their subculture. You know, goth kids are following a cultural construct as the core of their culture. Doctors are making people well. Hackers are trying to figure out why communications technologies work, trying to make them better, or figuring out how they work and trying to make them better. You know, I mean, does everyone see the fundamental distinction between a scientific society and a subculture? Is that pretty clear? You know, how many people in the room is that unclear? For how many people in the room is that clear? How many of the people in the room are unconscious? Thank you, Carl. You just gave your speech. Why are you unconscious? Did you actually end up sleeping last night or not? You crashed on the couch for 40 minutes? Okay, good. Yeah, because like the people who are crashing on the couch got tagged. That's always really sad to see. Yeah. Is Evil in the room? Is Evil anywhere here? There are actually pictures on the Rubicon site of what Jim and Rob did to Evil at DEF CON, which was not good. No, they not only tagged him, but they covered him in... Actually, I don't think there's a picture of this, but they duct taped about 50 flyers to his corpse. No, I'm talking about DEF CON 8 last year. I'm talking about... Oh, basically, the rule is... If you're going to a HackerCon and you don't have a hotel room, find a very hidden place to sleep, or you will have many things defaced on your body that people will be laughing at when you wake up.
Sleep, yeah. Meditation room, and
I'm confused. Does the medical community tag people? No, they have syringes. No, it's actually, no, honestly, a really big thing in medical schools, an honestly recognized tradition, is to be able to inject a saline or, you know, an otherwise innocuous IV in someone who is passed out or drunk. You know, it's not something that they need, but it's like, they're just gonna, you know, put it into him, know that he's going to wake up, you know, obviously turn him on his side so he doesn't asphyxiate and things like that. But, you know, it's just like tagging someone who's asleep in the hacker community. Doctors have their own little fucked up shit that they do to their fucking drunk, crashed out people. All right, my dad's a doctor. I have pictures of this shit.
Do you have pictures?
Yeah, no, I, you know, my dad, he looked like a pretty honest, decent person. He was a fucked up kid in medical school. He did some crazy shit to people. You don't even want to know. All right, for those of you who want to see this, we will put it on the pay-per-view section of the Rubicon site, which is currently under development, which you'll also be able to see the ill-fated Friday night round of Win NFS t-shirts. The PayPal account has been set up. So anyway, that's Hackers as a Scientific Society. And now here's the kicker. Oh, Andrew, you just walked in? Jesus Christ, you missed... So this is going to make no sense to you.
I set my alarm for 11 o'clock.
Yeah? You set your alarm for 11 o'clock?
P.M.
Good job.
What was that about scientific community?
Yeah. Andrew... Actually, I did say that hackers are practical.
Hackers are practical. Scientists
aren't. Okay, Andrew, would you go in the back of the room? Because I know if you sit right there, I'm going to start debating with you and not speaking to this lovely audience here.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
We can save that for tonight.
Exactly. Yeah, when we go home. If we're debating during this... Oh, and this is Andrew Hobgood, my roommate, everybody, for those of you...
Also kicked your ass?
Huh?
Also.
Yes, he was also part of the team that kicked... He was the part of the duo that kicked my ass in Win NFS t-shirts. They got three of Forno's impossible questions right. I got none. I couldn't even answer the last one in the game, which was, while you were passed out in the bathtub, how many, or name any five people who were in your room at the time. I couldn't do it. I forgot myself. I didn't even mention myself. Suffice to say, I was probably still drunk at that point. But anyway. Now the last part of it. You know, the title of the speech is Hackers and the Society of Accidental Guardianship. This is the original point of this speech. I'm arguing that while hackers run with the hacker ethic, and the hacker ethic is what's going to be replacing the Protestant ethic, what will fundamentally separate hackers from the rest of the society following the hacker ethic is the notion of guardianship. And this has a lot of different facets. Does anyone know what time it is? How much time I have left?
7:02.
Huh? 5:02. Fuck, I have to explain this in 5 minutes? God damn it. All right. I love nicotine. Okay. Going back to the point of guardianship, what's going to separate hackers from everybody else in the information society is an intense sense of guardianship. And this works primarily in two ways. The overriding point is that hackers feel as if they own the technologies that they use. And I know it's a catchphrase to say, like, I own Zord your box. I own Zord your PBX. You know, I own Zord the CLEC. Yeah, right.
I own Zord your box.
Exactly. I mean, it's considered a catchphrase, but when I say ownership, I mean, the quickest way that I can explain this is like, people who have pets, you obviously own your pets. You know, you don't. Well, no, let me finish here. You own your pets. Your pets are technically your property, but no pet owner would ever think of their pet in terms of their property. You know, your pets are your friends. Your pets are, you know, part of the family. You never feel as if you own it. Your pet isn't your slave. Your pet is a valued member of your social fabric to a certain extent. Hackers own communications technologies in the same sort of way. They know that they don't own the property. You know, they know that they don't own all of the wires that are running across the internet. But at the same time, they have this tremendous sense of ownership over all of the technologies. You know, they don't necessarily respect them, but they feel as if they own them. They have a sense of guardianship over them. You know, hackers don't release exploits because they want script kiddies to use them to, you know, tear shit up. They release them because they want to point out the vulnerabilities so people can fix them. You know, it's a flawed example, I agree, but it all goes to the sense of ownership. You know, script kiddies, you know, deface websites is also a sense of ownership. You know, and that works on two levels as well. One, the more websites that are defaced, the more people are going to spend on security and the more secure, you know, network technologies are going to become. And the second part is, by tagging, by defacing, they've said to people, you know, this is not your property. You know, they've said that I can take this over at any time. You always have to be aware of that. And I'm taking over, all I'm doing is adding a stupid little page in Hacksource speak on the front of it. But it was extraordinarily easy for me to do this. What's going to happen when your competitors start doing it? You know, while there is a lot of corporate espionage and while people are hiring hackers, you know, governments and things like that to engage in info war, you know, against people like that, the vast majority of all of the hacking that goes on the network is still fundamentally benign. It's to say, I got into your box. You know, hackers don't pull credit. I mean, I honestly believe that in my definition of hacker, hackers don't pull credit cards because they're going to sell them to the Russians for, you know, 25 cents a card. They're not doing it saying, like, I'm going to get all this money when I get these credit cards. They're doing it because they're like, haha, I got all these fucking credit cards. Aren't you scared? Aren't I REIT? You know, that's their motivation. Their motivation is saying, your systems are insecure. Patch your fucking shit. You know, it all goes back to the sense of ownership. I mean, there's that sense of protection, that sense of ownership. And the real linchpin here goes back to freedom. Keeping the network free and open. The more that corporations implement technologies and do things to try to make the network closed, to try to make the network proprietary, to try to make the network a motivation for personal profit and gain, the more hackers are going to come up and say, I ain't having that shit. You can laugh at any time. Yeah, thank you. But, I mean, you understand the point there. You know, the more that technologies come out, you know, Windows, things like that. Why is Linux a respected operating system? Someone give me a reason why Linux is a really respected operating system.
Open source?
Okay, yeah, I know we're both BSD freaks, but for the sake of this argument, we'll just cancel it out. Yeah. Huh?
Media hype?
It's you, sir.
It works. It does what it does well. Liability.
Exactly. But are you saying that other operating systems... I mean, when you say that Linux works, do other operating systems not work? Hmm? Right. Well, that's getting a little bit away from the point. But I believe Linux is not popular because Linux is good. And while the BSD people in the audience would, you know, while there's a holy war going on about this, Linux is not respected necessarily because it works, but because the predominant operating systems don't work. If Windows never crashed, if Windows was never easily exploited, if Windows did exactly what it was supposed to do, let's, for the sake of argument, let's say 75% of the time, Linux wouldn't be popular. Nobody would go to Linux. You know, the reason that Microsoft still maintains, you know, such a dramatic market share is not because their product is good. It's because of marketing. Is anyone going to disagree with me on that point? No. Exactly. The reason that Linux is popular is because the stuff put out by Microsoft doesn't work. This is proven. This is why there's such an interest. This is why there's such a revolution in, you know, in going back to technologies that work. Unix works. Unix is a really old technology. You know, BSD 4.4, there's code, you know, in newly released BSD variants that is 20 and 25 years old. Older than that. Hell, how? 1965, 30 years old. Older than most of the people in this room. Why? Because it works. And that's why we're going back to it. We're going back to technologies that work. And it all goes back to the idea of keeping the net free and open. The more that corporations try it, you know, to put stuff out there that doesn't work to make a profit, the more hackers are going to go back to technologies, refine technologies, and invent technologies that work. And it all ties in with, you know, that overall sense of guardianship, you know? When you own something, when you own a network, you want it to work. You want it to work for everyone. You know, why do people still have AT&T and Ameritech? Why did CLEX fail, like Andrew was saying on a panel discussion before? Because the technologies that are there work. When you pick up your phone, you're going to get a dial tone 99% of the time. It works. You know, the reason that why cell phone proliferation is so great in the second and third worlds is because people's home phone service doesn't work. Most people don't have phones because half the time, less than half the time when they pick up their phone, they're going to get a dial tone. You know, the outage of the telephone network in most second and third world countries is far more common. I mean, this doesn't apply to all second and third world countries, but in ones with really high cell phone penetration. I'm talking second and third world countries, not like these European countries that have, you know, cell phones just because they can. Like the Philippines. The Philippines is a good example of a second/third world country where cell phone proliferation is getting huge. Brazil is another example. Their wired telephone networks don't work. You know, in the vast majority of homes in Brazil and the Philippines, you're going to pick up that phone and get a dial tone maybe 50% of the time in the vast majority of the country, in the really decrepit urban areas, because they can't keep a wired infrastructure there. But cell phones always work. You're always going to be able to, you know, to hit a bunch of numbers on your cell phone and have it work. Yeah, the quality of service is generally pretty poor, but they work. The reason that the wireless web is being so intently developed is not because we like it. The wireless web sucks. All right, anybody who's used real graphical browsers hate the wireless web. It's good for nothing more than, you know, messaging people, checking the weather, or checking flight information. You know, or playing games. But then again, you know, you already have games on your cell phone that you can play without having to call someone. The reason that wireless web technologies are so profitable is because people in these second and third world countries who are using them have never experienced the web that we have. You know, they're looking at these things. They're saying, oh, wow, oh, my God, I can get the news on my phone, you know, in four lines, and it's just coming down there. Like, wow, this is really cool shit. You know, that's the first time that they've seen the web. That's why people are spending so much money developing wireless technology. It's not because we're going to use them, you know. It's because the second and third world, who have never had an experience with web technologies, are going to use them. And it all goes back to, well, that was a pretty bad side point, but it all goes back to keeping the net free and open and working, you know, making it work. Hackers develop technologies that work and that are creative and that are good. And the reason they do that, I believe, is because they have a fundamental sense of ownership over the networks that they do. Okay, just for the sake of time, is anybody going to disagree when I say that the hacker community is subversive? Nobody's going to disagree with me on that? How many people agree that the hacker community is fundamentally subversive? How many people disagree with me when I say the hacker community is fundamentally subversive?
How many people are too hot to think?
Yeah.
How many people are just too damn hot?
Andrew, even though you have a hot fiancé, you are not hot. No, his fiancé is actually quite hot.
So is your sister.
You're welcome. Did you just say so is my sister? Josh, I hate you. But anyway.
Can we judge?
Huh?
Let's get your sister up and judge.
No. No. Absolutely not. And as I'm saying this, Josh is jumping on the network on his computer right now and trying to find a picture of my sister so he can put it on the projector.
Is there one available?
No. Okay, let's stop talking about my sister, all right? Okay, the final point of this. Hackers and the accidental society of guardianship. I'm not going to get into why it's accidental, but have people seen that point? That yes, it is a society of subversive guardianship. I mean, it's subversive for the people who disagreed with me when they said that it was subversive. It is subversive a lot of the ways. You know, it's subverting the dominant paradigm. The hacker ethic is subverting the dominant Protestant ethic. The way that hackers put their technologies and the way that their stuff works, they do it in subversive ways. You know, like Linus Torvalds didn't do the conventional thing when he said, I have a really great operating system that all these people have helped me develop. He didn't package it. He didn't have a marketing plan. He didn't have a whole bunch of people who were saying, oh, well, if you make the box red, it's going to sell more than if you make the box blue. No. That would be the conventional way to do it. And he might have gotten a little bit of success with that. But the vast majority of the people in the room would not know what Linux is if that's the way that he did it. He did it in a fundamentally subversive way. He gave the shit away. That is subversive. People in the Protestant ethic don't just give shit away. They always do it to get something in return. And that's what I say. Yeah, exactly. They would stop at almost nothing to keep things from being given away. You know, the only reason that the internet still works, the only reason that all of these corporations, you know, can sit together and why it can be such a wonderful thing. I mean, we had Prodigy. We had, what were some of the old CompuServe? You know, we had Delphi. Delphi. I was actually on Delphi for like 2 months. You know, we had all of these like, yeah, no doubt.
Don't forget
AOL. Those are my first like leet email denial of service attacks on like, fucking when I was like 12. Oh yeah, if I send 1,001 megabyte files to your email account, it will stop working. I was so geeked when I found out that. People hated me when I was 12. I was a really lame script kiddie back in the day. I was.
You still are now.
Fuck you, Andrew. Anyway. But like I said, it all goes back to keeping the net free and open, a sense of guardianship. And I think that's pretty much it. Does anyone have any questions? Or you had your hand up for something. You're going to take me to point on something?
You're saying that, number one, the Christian ethic, the Protestant ethic is...
I mean, well, let me just say the Protestant ethic is just the buzzword that he gave it. It came out of Protestant circles as a reaction to Catholicism, but it's fundamentally non-religious. That's just the buzzword for it. Right, but why do
whether we're talking about crack
No, no, it's no. They're too fun. No. Right. Fundamental motivation. People at like AMD did not give away this T-shirt because they thought that I was a really nice guy, you know. Because they gave it to Josh because he thought I worked for him. Gift giving in the Protestant societies are always predicated on receiving something in return, or in another way, predicated on because society tells me to, that it's my duty. It's my duty to give my kids gifts for Christmas. Not because I honestly want them to have a bike. Not because I think that that would be fucking cool. But because they want a bike and it's my duty to provide a bike for my child. But go ahead. Well, no, but the benefits are fundamentally different. Linus didn't release Linux because he thought, oh wow, all of these, you know, fucking little script kiddies are gonna love my ass. You know, he did it for the fundamental ideas of social worth, activity, caring. He gave the gift to the community, not because he was expecting to receive a benefit, but because that's the hacker ethic, to give. Not for what you're gonna get, but for the sake of giving. And yes, I'm sure that, he expected to receive that, but what he received were other gifts in kind, recognition. Recognition was not his motivation. His motivation was doing things for the community. But did you want to argue with me a little more on that?
Basically, all I'm really saying is, the whole point of it is, the hacker community as a community is not. It's not a community. There are no real leaders who are leading the movement in a particular direction. It's not a bunch of people who are all coming together for a common goal, common purpose. There may be a bunch of that. This group is a good example of that. We are all here for common purpose in a lot of cases, but we are not the hacker community. It's the whole point of the hacker ethic. If we're saying hacking is, we're going to take it apart, figure out why it works, put it back together in a better fashion. If we're going to call a hacker that, yeah, I'll agree with you on every issue. But I think that a lot of the people, especially now, are coming in and saying, I'm a hacker, and that means that I'm a vandal. Some of us are saying, I'm a hacker, and therefore I want to help everybody else better their security. I want to show that I'm intelligent, and I want to get a little bit of recognition, maybe, but I'm not out to hurt anybody. But the newest group who think that they are part of the hacker community and are posting on boards and are doing exploits and are vandals are basically egotists that are doing it for their own personal gratification, and they don't care who they hurt. And unfortunately, if I have the same name as you, I'm part of your community whether I like it or not. And if I break into your system and I destroy your information, and I say that I'm a hacker, and you don't, but you're also a hacker, we're going to be taken to be the same family, whether we like it or not.
Okay, now, before I let the other old guy speak and let the audience devour the both of you, I'd just like to say that you said destroy. You said that hackers destroy. I hope that I've tried to make the distinction that destruction is not a part of the hacker ethic. That when I said hackers, going from script kiddies all the way up to, all the way up to, you know, the geniuses, destruction is not a part of the hacker ethic. Kiddies that deface web pages, that vandalize them, don't destroy them. They say, here, admin, I patched the hole for you, and here's your old index file. I didn't destroy a thing. Anyway, the other old guy. Mm-hmm. Andrew, go ahead.
What he said about Linus not releasing it about releasing it with expectations, that's false. Linus released it simply as a community project because he thought it might be interesting if other people got hold of it. Because at that time, the only free Unix environment that was capable of running on both less Intel PCs was the Minix operating system, which was a commercial one, which he's made independent of. Okay? And that was not sufficient for what he felt people should use.
Yeah, how many?
So he took what he had and gave it to the community, asking for nothing and expecting literally nothing in return. When people picked it up and started patching it and doing things with it, he was blown away. Okay. And don't get me wrong, I don't use Linus as an idol. I think he's a very poor programmer. I don't think he's very good at what he does. Okay?
Yeah, like I said, I've used pretty much fundamentally flawed concepts to draw this all together, but just to get the point across.
Linus himself really did have no expectations. Mm-hmm. But when you bring up Phil Zimmerman and those characters, I mean, you're talking about guys who had a conscious civil disobedience in their context when they're sitting there releasing mm-hmm. their software for free.
Right.
And that harkens directly back to this sort of conflict that he describes between this, what he describes as the Protestant ethic and the hacker ethic. Because that was a way that the hackers could get back at the structured system and say, Zimmerman gave his friend a copy of PGP1, who then went around to payphones with an acoustic coupler, uploading it to sites all over the world as a massive export trick, okay? And said to the government, yeah, we know you've got laws, but fuck you, you can't enforce them. That was a direct attempt to subvert this Protestant ethic.
Okay, just to recap. Well, hold on. Just to recap and close something, I'd just like to close this with, you know, just one quick point. I'll debate anybody who wants to debate this afterwards during closing ceremonies.
For hours.
And I hope I fucking get my cell phone back. Otherwise, I'll have to turn it off for real, and I hope they do it this time. For people who are at social engineering last night. Okay, how many people... Yeah, I actually wish Josh had it. Like, we had a standing agreement that he would take it for. But anyway, back to the point. No, I didn't. Okay, fuck it. Screw that for now. How many of this speech, how many people in the room agree with 99% of what I said? Old guys, don't raise your hands. You're destroying my point. How many people agreed with like 80% of it? How many people agreed with the overall point, like the general stuff that I was saying? How many people, quote unquote, overall get it? Okay. We've hit the vast majority of the people in the room, the young people in the room, and I wish you two guys hadn't raised your hand. But how many people don't get it? How many people say, NFF, you're fucking wrong?
I think there's a difference between not getting it and
disagreeing with what you're saying. Right. Well, I mean, there's a distinction with that. Like, all I'm saying is that this is my belief of what will happen. Nobody can say what will happen in the future. They can say it with a reasonable degree of certainty, just like crypto. How many people were here for Matrix's speech? For John Erickson's speech on elliptical curve cryptography? You know, like he said, in cryptography, they can't prove that you can't break it, but they're pretty damn sure. I can't prove that this is what will happen, but I'm pretty damn sure. And I'll see you at Rubicon 20, and you know I'll do the exact same speech, and we'll see whether or not this shit actually came true. You know, there's a good possibility it might not, but of the leading minds in social science who are thinking about informatics and thinking about things like that, that this is what is happening, and the hacker ethic is what will replace the Protestant ethic. And you know, if you want to do more reading on this, I strongly recommend getting Pekka Himanen's book. It just came out this year, The Hacker Ethic. Please get. Are there any final questions or any final thoughts? I'm pretty much over my limit, but okay. Do you have a final thought or a question? Okay. Oh, Stephen Levy. I actually haven't read Crypto, but from what Andrew's talking about, I think I've picked up on most of the key points. Okay. A rock on. All right. Well, thank you very much. Closing ceremonies are in 5 minutes. If anybody wants to talk with me, I'll be outside. Thanks again.